I thought I wanted to say just a couple words about family this evening and look at a few scriptures, because I think that I think we're all in a family. Some of us have started our own next family. Some of us haven't, but will in the future. But it's a topic that is central in the scriptures. It's interesting because when you think of the way that God has structured our lives, right, the way he structured humanity and the way he structured his covenant, the family is so central in so many ways, and it's so obvious in so many ways. From Genesis, the creation of Adam, and Adam is alone, and it's the first thing that's not good, right? The first thing that's not good is that Adam is alone, and that he doesn't have a sufficient helpmeet in the creation. In all of creation, Adam does not have the helpmeet that God deems he needs. And so he creates woman. And so he creates this relationship from the beginning. And you see that relationship over and over again in the scriptures. And there's so much about it, right? Not just the earthly relationship, the family, the husband, the wife, the children, which we'll talk a little bit about. But it's obviously an image that's more than just what it is. It means more than what it is. So, you know, as we're all familiar, what do you see throughout the Old Testament? You see that relationship of God with the Israelites is the husband and the wife. And unfortunately, a lot of times, Israel is a bad wife, is a wayward wife. But, you know, if you think about that, that's really profound. Why does God use that analogy versus another analogy? Why doesn't he use the teacher-student analogy, or the mentor-mentee analogy, or the owner-slave analogy, which would be appropriate even? But he doesn't. I think you can make the argument that the analogy that you hear most in the Old Testament is that husband and bride, which is really remarkable given the relationship between Israel and God, right? Because it wasn't a co-equal relationship. Wasn't anywhere approaching co-equal, and yet that's the analogy that God chose for the Israelites. And then, of course, we see that continued, don't we? We see that where the church, with that relationship being revealed even in more glory, is the bride of Christ. It's really one of those, you know, it's important when it's a Genesis to Revelation theme, right? And that idea that the church is the bride of Christ. Again, there's so many parallel analogies you could use for the relationship of Jesus to his people, but he chooses that wedding analogy, that family analogy, and that tells you, I think you can extrapolate backwards from that, that tells you something about what marriage is supposed to be and about what family is supposed to be and the centrality that it possesses. I don't know if you've ever thought about it. I thought about it as preparing this. There's a lot of analogies you could use for the final judgment and the final reward, but what is the analogy that's used that we see in Revelation and by Jesus? It's the wedding feast. Kind of the ultimate celebration is this celebration of the relationship between Jesus and the bride of Christ, and it's just an enormous party. It's an enormous celebration, and Jesus uses that analogy, right, when he talks about who's going to be there and who's not going to be there. And what his church is like, what his people are like, and who are the virgins who are going to be brought into the feast, and who are the virgins who are going to be left out. So I think, you know, obviously this is a topic you could spend weeks and weeks and weeks on. We're just going to, I think, hit on some of the highlights, and then hopefully just spend some time praying about our families. We're all in different stages of life here. Some of us are in the older stages. Some of us are in the younger stages, but we all have a family. Most of us will end up creating our own family. Not all of us. Paul didn't, right, in a sense, but he had his church family. It's also interesting that the analogy for the church is that we are a family in and of ourselves, right? You see this kind of drawn out over and over again. I think it's an interesting topic for our times, because I think that we live in unfortunate times. I think that you've seen a destruction of the family structure in a way that that's interesting, in a way that even pagan societies don't do. It's is somewhat to our shame, I think, in Western culture, that you're more likely to stay married with an intact family where you value your elders and honoring your father and mother if you live in the East, if you live in Japan, if you live in China. You are, I think those values, even though it's not a Christian culture, are more inculcated into the family than they are in the West. I can't really speak to the UK. I'm not from the UK. I think in many ways the UK and the United States mirror each other, but I think the Americans in the room can definitely tell you that in the United States, it's amazing. The social transformations just in my life have been pretty amazing. You know, to be forthright, you may already know this, but when gay marriage was put to a popular vote, in every state that it was put into a popular vote, pre-Supreme Court decision, every single state it failed. Even in California, which was remarkable. California is one of the most liberal states in the United States. And yet, it was consistently defeated. Now, 70% of people support it. And if you put it to a popular vote now, I have no doubt that it would pass overwhelmingly. It's remarkable for people like me to look at in my lifetime how much that has changed, how much has changed over time. And people say, well, what does it hurt anybody? What's the harm? But it's fascinating because if you look at kind of the social science statistics, I pulled some of them before I came over. In the U.S., 64% of children in African-American homes are born in single-family homes. They're not. What you have is basically the disintegration of the family. What happens when the family disintegrates is typically you have the woman who is raising the children and the man is somewhere else. It's interesting because there's so much talk about women's liberation, but a lot of the changes that have happened actually end up being born by women. In terms of having to take care of whatever comes out of a non-marital, non-committed union. 24% of white children are born out of wedlock, 40% of Latino, 15% of Asian. There's that kind of interesting statistic. But you know, one of the things even non-Christians can't deny, all the social science research that shows that in any metric that you want, children from a family with one parent versus two parents are more likely any bad outcome you can think of. Less education, more likely to get involved in criminal activities, less likely to finish school, less likely to make money when they, or less income when they do get out of school, less likely to have a family that stays together themselves. So there's very real implication, and of course I didn't bring it, but if you looked at this since the 1940s, specifically in the United States, it's just a graph that goes up dramatically. Does that have impacts? It really does. You know, one of the things, and don't worry, I'll get back to the kind of the biblical family passages, but I think it's interesting, you look at the Bible and there's this idea of spheres of authority. You've probably heard it, right? You've got civil government. You also have church government, you have family government, you have individual government. And it's interesting because scripturally, so many things in the Bible fall to the family, right? When we see admonitions about educating your children, it's not with the civil government. It's with the family. It's the father and the mother's responsibility to educate their children. You know, who does the when you look biblically at least, the primary responsibility for something like welfare, where does it come to? It doesn't say the king needs to take an accounting, and in Israel, for example, the king needs to take an accounting, figure out who is in need, and minister to them. The primary agent of charity is the family. Now, sometimes the family's not there, so what do we do for people without a family? Well, we see in the New Testament, the widows and the orphans, they don't have a husband or a brother or a father. They're to be cared for by the church. But when these spheres of authority get blinded, unfortunately, I think in the U.S., we increasingly see the civil government as the substitute and the answer. And of course, the civil government does some things very, very poorly. And so it's not good. I thought kind of our first scripture that would be good to look at is actually in Exodus. You know, you talk about the primacy of the family. You know, the fifth commandment in Exodus 20. Verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving. So an interesting commandment, right? When you look at it in relation to all the other commandments, it's the first one where we have your relationship with somebody else on earth that's being discussed, right? In fact, sometimes people have confusion with how does this relate to the first four, but it's in the first table of the five versus the second table of the five. It's also the first commandment with a promise, isn't it? The promise that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Isn't that interesting? And again, for me, whenever I read verses like this, I always think, well, why didn't he put that? Couldn't you say, love the Lord your God, you know, you will have no other gods before me, so that you will live long in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Certainly, if you put God first, you are going to live long in the land, right? You could say that would be, if you didn't put God first, that would be a good reason for God to expel you. But he ties it to this commandment. And I think, you know, it doesn't say explicitly why, but I don't think it's too much conjecture to say, because your father and your mother represent the things that have come before you, God calls on you to honor them as we are to honor God. And by doing so, if we have an appreciation and an understanding of what has come before us, then I think God will bless us. He does bless us. And we see that. We see those kinds of commandments over and over again, right? What's the commandment in, where did I write it down? In Leviticus 19. Stand in the presence of the aged. Show respect for the elderly and revere your God. Why are we supposed to do that? Why is that important? When the covenant community, I was reading a commentator one time. I thought he made a good point, which was when we're born, everything is here already. Things, in a sense, are set up. And that's thanks to the efforts. It's thanks to the goodness of God, but it's also thanks to the efforts of the people who went before us. And especially if you're in a covenant family, in a covenant community, that means that there are your ability to kind of further the kingdom of God and your ability to follow God is a direct result of your parents, and hopefully of your parents' parents, and the people who went before them, the structures that we have, the institutions that we have, the things that you've learned. You know, you've probably read before, but I think it's very true. For children, your family is really your first relationship with authority, isn't it? It's where you learn what obedience means. It's where you learn what disobedience means. It's where you learn how men and women should relate to each other. It's where you learn how a husband and wife should relate to each other. It's where you learn what discipline is. It's where you learn what pain is. It's where somebody tells you no, and you have to learn what to do. It's your first school. It's really your first judge. There's so many things it's your first. And I think this has a lot to do with it. Now, if you're like me, you hear that and you think, that's somewhat intimidating as a parent. Isn't it? It should be. I hope it is. I really think that marriage and parenting and childbearing are the two most challenging things most of us will ever do. And I think there's a good reason for that. The marriage covenant is unlike any other relationship you'll ever enter in, right? There is no, friends are great. Love friends. They're, you know, life would be certainly a void without them. But you don't see in the scriptures that same emphasis on friendship. And it is important to have friends. It's important that the body pulls together, the body of believers. But it's really that marriage relationship, that covenantal family, is the one that we see over and over again that is the center. And I think one of the reasons for that is if the family is healthy, so many other things are healthy. If the family can govern itself and is successfully governed, the children are going to be able to govern themselves. And if you have a group of families that can govern themselves, the church job is so much easier, isn't it? And if you have families that can't govern themselves, The church's job is so much harder. The civil government's job is so much harder. Everybody's job is so much harder. Because if you can't govern your family, it affects so many other things, doesn't it? If it doesn't just affect you, it affects everybody. And it affects your kids. That's a somewhat frightening thought. You know, when I think the marriage relationship and the parenting relationship, the reason they're so challenging is that they really are a magnifying glass on ourselves. If you're my friend and you say something that I don't like, or I see something in myself that you bring out that I don't like, I probably just go home and call you less and don't seek you out to talk to you because it doesn't make me comfortable. Or I don't feel like you know me well enough to say that to me. Although good friends do that, don't they? But that can be a tricky relationship. You know, the problem with your wife, the problem with your husband is what? You can't leave. You're not leaving. And what do we know about marriage? This is true of marriage and parenting. We have an idea of what it's going to be. And it's never what it is we think it's going to be. No matter what you think it's going to be, if you think it's going to be Fantasy Island, it's not. Even if you have a realistic view of what it's going to be like, it's not. Because you've never been in that intense a relationship before. And you've never been responsible for raising little human beings and helping them form their moral universe and educate them and train them and teach them. And so it shows things about us that may be uncomfortable, that show us. And I think that's why marriage is such a crucible, and in a good way. Because you either change because you're committed and you make it work, or you don't. There's no middle ground. And I think this is why so many families don't survive, right? Because if you don't have that foundation, what do we have today? Everybody bases everything on the emotion of love. And of course, if your relationships are based on how you feel about somebody, I feel great when I'm dating them, and I may feel great when we're in our honeymoon, and then the first time that I hear you snoring, I may not feel as great about you. The first time your kids, you know, we all think, this is what I want my kids to be like. They're going to be like me, and they're going to like the exact same things I like, and they're going to respond to my great teaching, and then they don't, and they're not. Well, you guys are, but but you have to adjust that, don't you? It becomes this is not what I expected to be doing, or this isn't the situation I expected to be in. What do I do now? And if your answer isn't, I go to God, or I go to people who've done this, who are godly, or I look to the scriptures, or I pray about it. If your answer is, I go to the counselor who says, if you're not happy, then you ought to find your happiness. You ought to find your bliss, right? Well, my bliss is with that 20-year-old girl now that I have my 40-year-old wife, right? Or whatever. And this is what people do. So family is so important. And it's so hard. It's very hard. And that's what's fascinating about family. You choose your spouse. You don't choose anybody else in your family. You don't choose your brother and sisters. You don't choose your kids. You don't choose your parents. You don't choose your siblings. If we went around the room, I could tell you about the challenges in my family. My sister and I are at loggerheads. We're at loggerheads to the point that we really don't talk much now. And it's unfortunate. It has a lot to do with belief systems and the ability to tolerate someone else's beliefs, which, in my opinion, my sister can't do with us. But we all have those stories, don't we? And knowing how to navigate those things is hard, but it's important and it's good. So it's interesting, you know, think of Israel. So many things that they did were centered around that transmission of that knowledge. You know, Exodus 12 talks about, in the interest of time, I won't go there, but it's there if you look it up. What did they do every 7 years? The entire community came together and they read the entirety of the law. And it's important to understand, it wasn't just the men. Sometimes it was just the men that did ceremonial things, right? Because they were the spiritual leads of the family. This was the entire family. This was the children. Everybody needed to hear the entirety of the law every Sabbath year. Why? Because it needed to not just to have the people our age reminded of the law, but you also needed that transmission to be taking place. You needed the children to understand what built their society, what it was based on, and what was going to be important to them in the future. Think of that also, you know, another great example is at the Seder, at the Passover meal, right? You remember that. How does the Passover meal start? It starts with the oldest son asking the father, what is the meaning of this? And the description of the Passover. This is why we do this. It's really an interesting ritual, right? The way it's set up. There's not a lot of other rituals set up that way in the Old Testament. It's very specific. The oldest son is going to query the father, why do we do this? What are we doing here? Of course, if you were religiously observing the Passover, the son would know what you were doing, right? You did it every year. Why do we do that? Why doesn't God just say at your, you know, bar mitzvah or whatever, you'll do it one time and you'll be done? Well, because we're humans, right? We require constant reminders. But you see that transmission of knowledge from one to the other, and that importance of impressing, why are we here? What are we doing? What's important? Why are we a people? And what do you need to know about that? How do we transmit those ideas to our children, to our families? In any church, you have so many different, I can only imagine the stories and the things that go on that these three here that we know nothing about, right? One of the things you know about people is they're complicated. One of the disadvantages of being in the military is we go around and we meet people and we're like, oh, they're great, and it's great. And you don't know any of their backgrounds, and you're not really around long enough to get to know their backgrounds. And sometimes we've been lucky enough to be in a place for a longer period of time, and you'll find out things about people and be like, oh, wow, you know, there's like a lot of history there. There's a lot of struggle there. There's a lot of things these people have had to overcome. People are complicated. Everybody has things that they struggle with. That's why the church is so important also, to bolster those families that reinforce that, and if not there, to provide some of that reinforcement. So we could spend time looking at, you know, the New Testament gives a good amount of real estate to husbands, wives, children. This is what you're to do. You know, it reinforces those critical things of husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. Children, obey your parents. Those things are so central and just so easy not to do, right? I find in my life, so frequently, I think I'm doing something because I want you to appreciate it. You don't appreciate it, and I'm not doing what you asked me to do. And I say, but I'm doing it for this reason. Yeah, but that's not what is good. That's not what I asked you for. That's not what's good for the situation. And it's fascinating how hopefully you have these times in your life where you're like, you know, I thought this was one thing, and it's really another. And I didn't see that. You know, for me, a funny example is my mother can be somewhat domineering. And when we were married, I think many people have this where the mother, the son can do no wrong, but the woman he married gets the barbs. And my wife pointed out shortly after we were married, you know, I'm on a hook here and you're quiet. And what you're doing there is you're making a choice. If you can't step in and show where the allegiance lies, you've made a choice, and it's not for me. And that was such a thing for me. You know, he's laughing. Because I think many of us have been there. That kind of understanding of family dynamic, and what is it I'm supposed to be doing, and I'm not. And I think I'm doing a good thing. No, I'm staying out of the ruckus. Well, that's actually not what I should have been doing. But you don't realize that until somebody says, hey, dummy, this is what's going on. Is this what you want to happen every time we get together? Is this the dynamic? Then you've got to set some boundaries. So I think those are a few of the things I wanted to kind of mention as far as family and marriage and children and the things that go with that. I think we can maybe spend some time praying about that.